welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, unearthing Bismarck's past near the governor's residence. In a closer look with the Monitor, we'll check in with North Dakota Monitor reporter Michael Ochterlein as he explains that construction near North Dakota's governor's residence took an unexpected turn earlier this year when crews uncovered human remains and coffin fragments. He'll have what comes next. And a fall full of discovery is ahead at North Dakota Gateway to Science. And Dave Thompson and I will catch up on what's been happening at the special session of the North Dakota Legislature and other news across the region. But first, we return to Audubon Great Plains as we listen for the distinctive calls of birds moving through North Dakota this fall. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined again with Kelly Tevin. She's a senior outreach coordinator for Audubon Great Plains, and she works across North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska to protect birds in the places they need. Kelly was with us yesterday and told us about what happens with Audubon Great Plains. We're going to hear from specific birds in the fall migration here in North Dakota. Kelly, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Yesterday, you explained to us what fall migration is. You described it as a kind of a trickle of birds, a little maybe longer lasting than spring migration might be. And also, surprising to me, some birds migrate here for the winter. And then others, of course, are going as far south as Chile, as you said yesterday. And I want you to play some birds for us. Let's start maybe with a bird that I'm most interested in, which is a cardinal. I was surprised to learn that they're here in North Dakota. You tell me that their area of where they are expanding. What's a cardinal sound like?
So a cardinal has a very unique sound and call. We hear them a lot in the spring. The males are very territorial, so they're very happy to, you know, make themselves well known. And being bright red up in the tree, it's usually pretty easy to spot them in the spring when there's not as much foliage on the trees. One of my favorite things about the cardinal is that when they pair together, they're usually hanging out together all the time. So if you see usually a male who's paired, the female's not far behind. And they are, as you said, they're so much fun to look at and see in your neighborhood, easy to spot, but kind of a gateway bird for a lot of people to get into birding. So we can, yeah, absolutely listen to that song. And that is a bird that does stay here all winter, looks beautiful against our white snow, and will happily visit feeders, especially if you provide something like black oil safflower seeds or sunflower seeds.
Kelly, you're using the Merlin app. Tell me about the Merlin app and how easy it is for people to use wherever they are.
Merlin is an incredible app that allows people access to not only information about birds, to try to see birds and learn more about specific species, but to be able to turn on the microphone on their device and listen for birds as well. So maybe there's a bird call that you're hearing, you're not sure what it is, you've got lots of leaves on the tree. You can just turn on that Merlin listening portion and voila.
Instantly.
Yes, it's incredible. It has really opened up birding as something that we can much more definitively identify birds by their calls. Something that used to be a very niche skill now has been open to the general populace.
And I think Merlin, too, uses the data that we hear to maybe understand maybe this is a new place where this particular bird has been seen. And that's exciting for me.
It is. I have actually had, there are individuals who work with eBird, which is kind of a sister program of Merlin where you can report bird sightings that you've had, and have had someone reach out to me to identify, do you have additional supporting evidence that this is the bird you saw? This is kind of rare in your area for this time. So there are researchers and there are people who are very interested in knowing more about the sightings that we as community scientists and birders are seeing out there.
All right, give me another example of a bird that you are listening for this fall, Kelly.
So one of my more elusive birds, because they don't like to hold still very long, that are coming through during migration that we see here along our nature parks in Fargo is the American Redstart. And it is a charming little bird, and I love to try to see them. It's kind of like a game of hide and seek with the Redstarts in the park. So you definitely have to be listening for them in order to figure out where they are.
It sounds like it may be a small bird.
It is. It is a small bird. One of the really challenging things about listening for bird calls that people find is the song that the bird might be making in the spring when it's looking for a mate or establishing territory might not be the same sound it's making when it's coming through in the fall and just doing alert calls. So we have a difference between having to learn their songs and their calls, which can add a challenge.
Kelly, I've seen things advertised in magazines where people have a very directional microphone and they're wearing headphones to maybe isolate sound a little better. Is that needed?
I wouldn't say that it's needed if you're a more casual birder. If maybe you're looking for a very specific bird that tends to be a little quieter or high up in the canopy or flushes easily if you get close to it, then it might be investing, you know, worthwhile to invest in some equipment like that. But for the general birders, when I go out and lead birding groups, you know, we've just got our phones in our back pockets with Merlin running to check and see what we're hearing as we're out there on the trail.
Kelly, yesterday you mentioned this birdcast that kind of gives a forecast of where birds are going. Where can we see that?
So birdcast is a really interesting piece of technology. One of the most important uses for birdcast that we're finding out is working with municipalities to try to work on our lights out for migration campaigns. Some birds can become really disoriented by our artificial light in our cities, our towns, our streets. So during peak migration times, we've had great success in cities that have worked with Audubon and other bird research organizations to, when the bird cast is showing that migration is getting really high in that area, that they're turning out their lights to protect birds and help them conserve energy for migration. The bird cast can be found in a variety of areas. Whether you're on social media, maybe you've seen the tools, but you can also find it at birdcast.org. So easy enough there. And find the live migration maps, and you can see your upcoming forecast. You can look back and see how many birds are moving. And it's really incredible to see how our northern Great Plains are truly a hot spot for migration and how much birds need us to cooperate in order for them to have a successful migration experience.
All right, let's hear another bird that may be crossing our paths as they migrate this fall.
So one of our birds that we generally only see in this area coming through and then coming back again during migration seasons would be the swamp sparrow, which has a pretty unique call. Sparrows can be hard to identify visually, but tend to have relatively different calls or songs. So that's one way that listening for birds and getting attuned to their sounds can really help beginning birders or even expert birders identify what it is they're looking at, especially when they're like a small little brown bird. Mm-hmm. And we're like, which one is that? So here is the swamp sparrow.
It surprised me when you gave your owl talk that the 12 different owls that you talked about really had 12 distinctive calls. Is that pretty much the same across bird genres? For instance, sparrows, there are many different types of sparrows. They all sound different?
It can be, and it's unique because it is one of the ways that birds find each other. And, you know, with noise pollution in our cities and changing environments as well, there is concern about birds being able to communicate with one another and being able to hear each other over spans of distances, which used to be relatively quiet. And now with our urban noise sometimes, it's a little bit more challenging for them.
Kelly, if you were to give homeowners advice on what they could do in their backyard that would be most helpful to fall migration, what would you tell them?
So one thing that all birds need during migration is fuel to migrate. And so planting native plant species, even if it's a bird that's like an insectivore, there are certain plants that bring in the insects that bird would want to be eating. So choosing native plant species that are going to give our birds a more traditional diet that they've evolved to establish is really a great thing. Other things would be turning off unnecessary artificial lights at night. And also, our migrating birds aren't as used to the area that they find themselves in. So we see a lot of migrating birds having window collisions. So ensuring that your windows have some sort of outside decal, we find that dots spaced 2 by 2 inches away from each other, if you're looking to install something permanent, there are great varieties out there that people can be putting out. But even doing something as simple as hanging some strings on the outside of your windows during migration can allow birds to see the actual window and not just the reflection of trees and shrubs, which is what they normally see in the window before they fly into it.
Our neighbor actually put bird stickers on their windows. Is that a helpful thing to do?
It absolutely is. Some people are disappointed to find out in our climate that the best place to put those decals is on the outside, which can be difficult when you have the temperature swings that we have here in North Dakota. However, any change that we see people making to try to help our birds, especially during migration season, is something that we want to encourage. So educating, providing resources is really part of my job as an outreach coordinator to make sure that if people are looking to make those changes, or businesses or cities, that we're able to give them the most science-backed information available.
As we kind of wind up our conversation, Kelly, can you play a bird call that if we hear it, we should be kind of shocked because it's going to be rare, but it's something we might hear here in the state?
Absolutely. So there is one particular bird that, if anyone out there has seen the movie Listers, the yellow rail is the bird that they're looking for in North Dakota, particularly. They're standing outside covered in mosquitoes, clacking two rocks together. And it's not maybe the traditional sound that we would associate with a bird making, but there are lots of birds that make what we would consider unusual sounds. And the yellow rail is one of those elusive birds that does make an incredibly unique sound. It is likened to the tapping together of two rocks or marbles, and it is usually found deep within very thick wetland, very reedy areas, very weedy, you might say. And they do breed here in North Dakota, but it's very difficult to find them because they are so well camouflaged and are not very social creatures, to be honest. So that is one that I would say is really unique that a lot of birders would be pretty excited to hear. But a lot of people wouldn't even recognize it if they heard it as a bird sound.
I guess that to be a woodpecker.
It is a very unusual sound. Another bird that makes an unusual sound in our area as well would be the grasshopper sparrow, which is a lot more common, but like its name suggests, it definitely has a sound that's almost insect-like as opposed to what we would consider a general song.
Certainly does sound like an insect more than maybe a bird. Kelly, I'm sure we could go on all day because there are how many species of birds that at least call North Dakota home for a day or two each year?
Oh my goodness. So we're talking in the high hundreds when we're talking about birds that are migrating through. And migration patterns can change from time to time. But generally, we're seeing huge numbers of species when we are talking about migration time of the year, which is what gets birders so excited to get out there. It's this short window that's very exciting to see who's coming through, who might be outside, and to go and try to find them and find that opportunity in nature with other like-minded folks.
Kelly Tevin is the Senior Coordinator for Outreach with Audubon Great Plains. You can learn more about birds found across North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska, and listen to their calls at audubon.org/great-plains. Kelly, thanks for joining us and for bringing some of the sounds of fall migration to our listeners.
It's been my pleasure, Craig. Thanks so much.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
This is a closer look with the monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. A construction project near the North Dakota governor's residence has uncovered a long buried chapter of Bismarck's history. Human remains and pieces of a coffin were discovered in May as crews worked on a new security fence and driveway. Ground penetrating radar has since identified as many as 29 anomalies that could indicate additional graves beneath the site. The area was once part of Bismarck's earliest cemeteries. Archaeological work is now underway to determine what remains there and relocate any remains that are found. Joining us for a closer look with the monitor is North Dakota Monitor reporter Michael Ockerley, who has been following this story. Michael, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Let's begin with what happened. Yeah. How were these human remains first discovered, and what kind of construction was taking place near the governor's residence?
Okay, so in the 2025 session, there was a bill to enhance the security around the governor's residence. The fence had, you know, it was a little too close to the residence. We had to move it out a little bit. They were going to change where the driveway came into the governor's residence. So once the funding was in place for that, construction crews this year started digging up area around 4th Street and Boulevard Avenue. If you're familiar with Bismarck, it's right on the corner there, on the far corner edge of the Capitol grounds. And yeah, they started digging in to put these large fence posts, kind of fancy fence posts, and started as they were digging in some of those around the property, construction crews did find and struck some human remains and some remnants of a coffin. And so that was in late May. And
What happened next? What happened when those were uncovered?
Well, obviously the construction crew stopped and they called the North Dakota Historical Society of North Dakota, and they had their team of archaeologists come out. They brought their ground penetrating radar and they started using it around where that fence post had struck, had dug down a little bit. And they did find some anomalies there.
Interesting word, Michael.
Yes. And so the anomalies is the key word, because the ground penetrating radar cannot discern between, you know, human remains, or if it's a tree root, or maybe it's a line of some kind or some other utility. It can't discern that. So really someone needs to go in there and actually see what the anomaly is, which brings us to today, really.
Now walk us through the work that's underway now. How will archaeologists determine whether those anomalies were graves or whether they're something else? Just look at them one by one?
They're going to do it very carefully and one at a time. I mean, they don't want to rush these things. If you were to drive by the governor's residence today, you'll notice there was a large privacy screen up around the fence, and there's an awning there. And so there is a team working to slowly kind of see what each of these anomalies, what it ultimately is. And I mean, this corner of that property was a historic cemetery for Bismarck, dating back to the 1870s and 80s, one of the first cemeteries in the town. And so that kind of brings us
I'm sure if anything additional is found, it'll be treated with the utmost respect. And walk us through from the moment, perhaps, if something happens to be uncovered that's thought to be human remains, through the eventual reburial, how does that process progress?
It took the Office of Management and Budget a little while to contract with an archaeologist. They've also contracted with a local funeral home and crisis care chaplaincy to ensure that the remains are handled with reverence and care. But the goal would be, if they do find remains, they will the archaeologist will be able to identify typically the age and gender of the remains, but they will not be able to do any DNA testing. But those remains would come up, be transferred to the funeral home, and then reinterred.
Michael, let's turn to the history of the property. Mm-hmm. What was the cemetery and when was it used? You talked about the late 1800s, and do we know about the people who might have been buried there?
We don't know much about the people that have been buried there. The records have been scarce, but the cemetery was used in the 1870s and 80s, pretty typically. One historian said that one of the earlier people who wrote about the town a little bit said that up to 70, a little over 70 bodies had been buried there. And then ultimately St. Mary Cemetery, Fairview Cemetery opened, and some of those bodies were moved, but not all of them. as we know now. But it still remains a question of like how many human remains are underneath the ground there.
Michael, your reporting tells us that this isn't the first time human remains have been discovered in the area. What was found during construction projects in 1903 and again in 1959?
Yeah, so this has been an ongoing kind of situation with this part of land on the Capitol grounds. In 1903, the city was putting in a trolley line, which I can't even fathom the trolley line here now, but they were putting in a trolley line, and they did discover about a dozen sets of human remains when they were going through that portion with the trolley line. And so those were reinterred at the time. And then you flash forward about 56 years later, in 1959, they were putting in the first governor's residence on that location. And they found, about five more sets of human remains. We have been finding remains as the area is kind of slowly developed in that area of the Capitol grounds. But the Office of Management and Budget will point out that when they constructed this current governor's residence in 2016, completed in 2018, they didn't find any human remains. So they did believe that this problem had been put in the past, but apparently not.
There has been some criticism. Who's Tory Jackson and what has he said?
Tory Jackson is a local attorney, but he's also a member of the Bismarck Historical Society. But speaking in his personal capacity, because that organization is not taking a position on anything having to do with this story, his criticism was this was a known spot. You had previous construction projects that had discovered human remains, and so therefore, regardless if you didn't find any the last time, you still should have had an archaeologist, a survey team come out and do this kind of ground penetrating radar and kind of site work ahead of time. So you would have known that there may be human remains in this fence track or this driveway track. So it would have prevented the work from having to halt in that period. And now, we kind of have this additional cost that is going to be fitted to the state. Right now it's at $155,000 for the archaeologists and kind of excavation. But really we don't know the final cost, because we don't know what they're going to find. Of the 29 anomalies, how many sets of human remains are they going to find? And what the funeral and reinterring costs. I mean, there's just so much that we don't know that a final cost is really hard to predict right now. So we actually don't know how much extra this is going to add to the project cost, but it's an unexpected expense that is now going to be put on the OMB budget and ultimately the taxpayers in North Dakota.
And the legislature approved $2.35 million total dollars for security improvements, of which this fence was part of that. Michael, has it been the Office of Management and Budget's response that they couldn't have known, or have they responded differently to the suggestion that this discovery should have been anticipated?
They believe that because there was no because there were no remains discovered recently when they did the newest governor's residence there, they believed it was in the past. They also pointed out that this project, this fence and driveway project, has been known since spring of 2025. It had been written about. And so anybody with knowledge of the area should have come forward and said something ahead of time. They pretty much assumed if there were any problems, someone would have said something.
Has the discovery, Michael, changed the construction plans, or is the state still expected to complete the fence and driveway as originally designed?
It is still continuing, and larger portions of the fence have gone up. I mean, they just did work on the driveway as recent as last week, but that area still is fenced off. So there is still some question about that area. There was talk about moving the tract of the fence so it doesn't interfere with that area, and then they could kind of finish it that way. That has not been determined yet. And so it could still proceed once this excavation is done.
After, I guess, this construction project is resolved, do you anticipate that this investigation then could change how the state approaches future work on historically sensitive areas around the Capitol grounds, or even elsewhere in North Dakota?
Well, I definitely think it's raised questions, especially considering the history of this site. Why wasn't this seen on the front end? And so I think there could be some questions to process going forward, especially on areas of the Capitol grounds. Maybe we should get an archaeologist involved earlier in the process just to kind of look through the history and make sure that there's nothing unexpected that they'll find out there. Because, I mean, this is a historical area that dates back, you know, more than... 150, 160 years now that they were kind of using it as a cemetery, and we're still dealing with the after effects this many years later. But again, that remains to be seen. But I do think it has raised some questions and may kind of change processes around the Capitol grounds going forward.
Michael Ochterlein is a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor, and you can read his complete reporting and the investigation and work near the governor's residence. And you can read it all at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Michael, thanks for joining us for A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having us, Craig. Please sign up for our newsletter.
Still to come on Thursday's Main Street, a fall full of discovery at North Dakota Gateway to Science. And Dave Thompson will bring us all up to date about what's happening in Bismarck as the legislature is meeting in special session. That's still ahead on Main Street. Stay with us.
This is Our Living Lands. And I'm Jill Freitas. Museums have often been a place where colonial stereotypes are upheld, but a new generation of Indigenous professionals is working to change that. Journey Lebeau is Northern Arapaho and a graduate student at the University of Colorado Boulder. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spaulding, spoke to Lebeau about museums, Indigenous representation, and more.
Could you share a little bit about your personal connection with your homelands and the environment, and maybe your favorite place or thing to do outside?
So that's just my Arapaho name is Eagle Woman, and I'm Northern Arapaho. My name is Journey Lebeau. I grew up in a place called Laramie, Wyoming, where the University of Wyoming is at. So it's about a 3-hour travel between the Wind River Indian Reservation and then Laramie, Wyoming. So during the summer is when I'd had the ability to actually go back to the reservation and, you know, have the time to actually spend with family during our Sundance. Another place that I really enjoy is a place called Moxon Lake, which is on reservation land, and it's only catered towards tribal members. So that is another location where, you know, I get to spend time with my family. We get to fish, you know, go out into the waters, you know, have barbecue. So it's a really nice time to just kind of reconnect with people and, you know, the land and, you know, that we have.
And can you talk a little bit about your work and what you're focusing on right now?
I am in the Museum and Field Studies program at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm currently working in the anthropology collections at the Natural History Museum on campus. My main purpose is working in collections and making sure to have that knowledge of, you know, collections care, making sure that, you know, everything that is being repatriated back, belongings, ancestors, that they have someone there that is, you know, able to understand and have kind of that, I guess, homey vibe for them to be okay with. And I want to have that ability to like basically be in the room with these, you know, belonging spirits, letting them know that there is someone who is familiar in that environment, in that space, and that I'll have that ability to communicate and let them know that we're doing everything in our, you know, capabilities to make it comfortable for them and hopefully get them back home.
Why is it important for Indigenous voices to be a part of museum curation, and how are Indigenous approaches to museum curation different than non-Native ones?
Yeah, it's so important to have Indigenous voices in museums. I can go off of experience right now. I'm actually helping with the label curations for our new exhibit in the CU Natural History Museum. I believe now they switched it to the Museum Institute, but my I guess the anthropology section here has done an amazing job in including Indigenous voices. They have gotten contact with my tribe, my TIPO office, in making sure that, you know, the signage, the labels, what they're putting into the exhibit is, you know, right. I want to say that there is a shift happening in museums in general. There is a more empathetic younger generation of staff coming in who have a better understanding of, you know, the history of Native people and making sure that they're doing things correctly. And I think that's really amazing.
What would you like to see for the future of Indigenous representation in museums? And how do you think we get there?
I want to be there to help in general for all Indian country, not just my tribe. And I guess becoming like an advocate in a way to make sure that Indigenous voices are seen and that they're heard, and just kind of changing the culture of museums as a whole. And in a way, you are kind of decolonizing it in a way. And I think that if we continue to push into these spaces and to create understanding in the way that, you know, Indigenous people think are, I think that's kind of, I guess we'll push it further.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The Fargo Moorhead Quilters announces the 2026 Metro Quilt Expo, September 25th and 26th at Veterans Memorial Arena in West Fargo. More than 200 quilts are expected to be on display, along with quilting demonstrations and vendor exhibits. Information is available at fmquilters.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined by Emily Montgomery. She's a STEM educator at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Of course, that's the beautiful structure we see on the banks of the Missouri River in Bismarck, and they do incredibly fantastic work providing an accessible way for really people of all ages, not just kids, but from us adults too, to learn a lot more about science. Emily, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Happy to be here.
Okay, some house cleaning first. Labor Day. I bet we might be closed that day.
We are closed on Labor Day, unfortunately. But check out our website for our hours and when we're open. We have a lot of fun things coming up that I'm really excited to share that you won't want to miss out on.
Let's have the list. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So our club school is back in season, which means our clubs are back in season as well. So we have our STEM Adventure Club, which starts September 28th. That registration and payment for that is online. We also have Coding Club, which is almost over halfway full. That is free, but you must register online to attend. And it's for middle school and elementary school, whereas STEM Adventure Club is just for elementary students. You can find all that registration on our website. Again, STEM Adventure Club is you have to pay, but Coding Club is free. We also have mini camp coming up. When there's no school, make sure you check out our website, because if you're not sure what to do with your kiddo, we have mini camp for the whole day. So that's still, we like to say that it's similar to school, but it's a lot more fun because they're able to do experiments, be more hands-on with learning, just as school is as well. But we do a lot more integrative experiments that they might not get to experience at school. So that's on September 21st. We're doing our very first one. We also have Preschool Discovery Hour coming up on September 9th, and we are doing solely just Wednesdays now for our Preschool Discovery Hour.
Is that every Wednesday?
Not every Wednesday, I wish, but it will be the second Wednesday of every month. So the next one coming up is September 9th, and that is going to be a Happy Harvester theme. I do a different theme for every month, and with fall coming up, it's a great way just to kick off, learn about the science of harvesting and STEM, and it's all on a preschool integrated level, which makes it really fun. We also have our International Observe the Moon Night coming up on September 18th. We are one of the landing spaces for NASA, with just creating all the different parts of what NASA would like us to learn about and teach the public. We're that space with Gateway to Science, which is really amazing. And we are a part of the International Observe the Moon Night that's happening nationwide. However, We are doing it September 18th on that Friday, and that will be from 6 to 8 p.m. So we will have people here with telescopes to look at the moon and be outside. Hopefully the sky is clear enough. And we will have actual telescope as experts there, so they will know what to all explain to you if you have never really had interest in the moon or space, or you are a long time person that's very fond of our closest neighbor in space. You can come to either of those. We also have our Gateway After Dark coming up, which is chess and charcuterie. That is our adult event on September 15th from 7 to 9 p.m. And you can register for that online. That will be for any level of chess. If you're like me, where you think you know a little bit about chess, but then when you sit down and you actually realize you would like to know a little bit more about it, that's where your level is. You can be there. If you're someone who's been an aficionado at it for quite a few years, it's also for you too. So it will be for all levels. And then we also have Worldwide Day of Play on September 26th, which is a Saturday, and we will just be integrating play. I think we lose that so much, especially in this day and age, just the importance of play for honestly anyone. I was going to say elementary students, but that's for any age right now, that just play is so crucial for our brain chemistry and just rewiring those neurons to just realize we can be tangible with our hands and do things and create joy just through the simple art of play.
We were talking with some family that now that school started, when do we get a play? When do we get a play? And it's something right? that we sometimes forget when we cram our calendars full of sports and full of activities. So that's just great. Like you, I'm a beginning chess player, so that would fit perfectly for me. And the Happy Harvesters Preschool Discovery Hour must be a load of fun.
It will be a lot of fun, and we integrate play into it as well, so you have a little bit of STEM, a little bit of play, and it's all made for preschooler at that age level, so it's a lot of fun.
And with the lunar eclipse on our minds that happened recently, mm-hmm. My goodness, what a better time to figure out how to look at the moon, maybe even with a nice telescope. Yes. Emily Montgomery is a STEM educator at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Event dates, details, and registration information are all available through the museum website. Just Google North Dakota Gateway to Science, and better yet, go there. Go to Bismarck and take a peek. Emily, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Yes, thank you.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson, has been busy over at the Capitol this week. Of course, North Dakota legislature is having a special session. It's a quick one. Dave, welcome back to Main Street. Kratom bills have advanced, including a permanent full ban in North Dakota. It's been one of the highlights, Dave.
Yes. Now, let me tell you about that bill in particular. It wasn't a full ban when it started. It was amended to become a full ban. It passed the Senate this morning on a vote of 46-1. However, the House has some people in there who don't want a full ban, so they may try to get that amendment off the bill. So this will be one to watch. The House is going to take it up a little bit later, but not today.
So a full ban would include everything from natural kratom to synthetic derivatives. Is that correct?
That is correct, right.
And the reasoning, Dave, for the full ban is what?
There's some evidence, they heard some testimony in the committee, that natural kratom can cause some same problems. It's kind of acts like an opioid almost. And yeah, then you've got the synthetic stuff, and they're worried about all kratom. Plus, you know, if you get a bottle of kratom from, you know, one of the suppliers, you don't know what's in it. You don't know what actually has been added to it. So that's the argument they're making to vote for the bill. What the House is saying, you know, we need more study on this, but is it right to ban everything? So there may be an effort to get that full ban off that bill.
And of course, the governor weighed into all of this in his State of the State address before the legislature yesterday. What did the governor have to say?
Governor had to say he would prefer that they pass a full ban because it mirrors what the feds are doing, and it mirrors what the emergency that the Board of Pharmacy in North Dakota did on Kratom. Law enforcement, I found out this morning, is basically saying it would be easier for them if you just banned Kratom together because it would put a lot more time and a lot more people to determine if you've got real Kratom or this synthetic stuff.
Governor said that perhaps there are stories floating around out there of how Kratom has helped individual people, and he wasn't interested in any of that. He just wants to look at the science. Is that an accurate description of what he had to say, Dave?
Absolutely. That's very accurate what he had to say. The one senator who defended the use of real Kratom, we'll call it that, said that he knows a number of men. Kratom has been able to help them with pain management and some of their other male problems. I won't go any further than that.
Dave, data centers have been discussed relative to non-disclosure bills that have been in front of different governing bodies here in the state of North Dakota and across the country. Doesn't look like much is going to move forward with that.
No, it doesn't, because they came back and said, hey, we're doing this anyway. The only reason we do an NDA, you know, a non-disclosure agreement, is to make sure our competitors don't know what we're up to. And, you know, a number of the lawmakers kind of bought that. There would still be open records for media. We could still look at these things. And the governor also basically said, if you're going to do an NDA, make sure all your I's are dotted, your T's are crossed, and you're doing it for the right reasons.
Dave, the legislature has rejected attempts to add child care to discussion, I guess, in this special session, as well as full-on data center moratoriums.
In the child care thing, which was kind of interesting, there's a waiting list for child care in North Dakota. And legislators from both parties said, yes, we underfunded it in the regular session. So the Democrats were going to try to come up with $9 million. Now, the majority, Republicans, said, no, we'll wait until the actual session of the legislature, the real session, which is coming up in just a few months, and we will deal with that at that time.
Dave, is the general thinking of legislators that this was a necessary special session at this point?
It's mixed. I've heard from a lot of people who said, yeah, we probably needed to do this because, you know, there was a federal ban on Kratom coming down. And there was really, you know, this whole thing about the new military gallery raised up, and they want to correct that, too.
What is the status of the bill that will support the military gallery?
It has not yet been voted on, but it's been voted out of committee. They added a $20 million line of credit from the Bank of North Dakota, and they removed some conditions and $15 million in state funding that was approved for it. And it was approved by a 34-4 vote in this committee. This is a Joint Appropriations Committee. There are still some angst about it because, you know, it was built thinking they were going to have a lot of donations. The donations did not happen, so construction had to halt on it. So they said at the very least, we need to do something to make sure the construction that has been done already is safe. You know, you cover it. Or if you just go ahead and finish it. So there's still a lot of discussion to be had on that one, too.
Well, all this is happening kind of as a matter of course. The state's piggy bank is growing larger and larger and larger with money that is pouring in, unanticipated, I'll add, from oil tax money that's been collected.
You know, it is interesting. You know, they were expecting it wasn't going to be as robust as it has been because, you know, production had kind of flattened out and prices were not very good. Well, all of a sudden, Gulf War comes and we have productions that ticked up a bit, but the oil prices have really gone up. So they're making money off oil taxes. And they will have some money to set aside, and they're talking about it, keeping in the SIF fund, which is the Strategic Infrastructure and Investments Fund. That is for one-time projects. What they have done in the past is borrowed money from the SIF fund to balance the general fund budget. And now they're thinking, we're not going to do that. We're going to follow the governor's recommendation to start cutting back on, you know, spending, cost to continue, that type of thing.
Dave, is money from the SIF fund for these one-time capital projects, do schools ever enter into that conversation?
Not yet, because schools are funded a different way. However, there's been talk about that as a way to fund schools.
All right, Dave, let's turn away from politics for just a bit. A kind of tough story. Two bats have tested positive for rabies in Bismarck. It's not that a bat has tested positive, but that two in the same area have.
Not only that, they found dogs who had encountered these bats and bit them. So they're basically saying, be on the alert. This is fairly rare for North Dakota. But if you've got a couple of bats with rabies, they're saying, stay away from bats if you see them. And there are, occasionally you'll see some bats around town. And they're just basically saying, you know, don't touch. If you see a bat that's fallen on a sidewalk, don't touch. Get the authorities, get rid of it that way.
Dave, I'm not going close to any bats anywhere.
Amen. Only Dave, when it's a strike of a baseball bat.
There you go. A little bit different, but hey, the state school superintendent, Dave, is doing a little teaching himself, albeit as a substitute.
Right. He has wanted to do that. He's been thinking about doing that. He has his teacher's license. He's a high school teacher. But what he wants to do is spend a day in elementary school, a day in middle school, and a day in high school. And he's going to do that a few times during the year to basically say, I got to get a feel of how students are reacting to teachers, what teachers need to do to get a better handle on what he may have to come up with some, you know, funding requests or maybe some changes he'd like to see. But he's really excited about it, and several staffers in DPI are also going to do the same thing.
Good luck for him, and congratulations for him for wanting to do that. I hope students treat him a little more nicely, maybe, than we treated our substitute teachers back in the day, Dave.
You're probably right, yes.
Dave Thompson and I, we review the news on Thursdays here on Main Street. Dave, legislature's almost, well, it is now. It's more than halfway through. Is it going to end on time Friday?
They're going to try very hard. They could possibly stretch into Saturday, but it looks like they can get a few things ironed out. They'll get it done.
Thanks for being with us on Main Street.
Glad to, Craig.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 3rd. In late August 1911, a horrible fire in Topeka, Kansas, did more than $100,000 damage in the business district. The reports noted that the J.C. Gresser Furniture Company and the Grebs Clothing Company were hit the hardest, but what caught readers' attention in North Dakota was the news that a photo studio also burned, killing a man named Evans who lived in the studio. The news spread quickly around North Dakota, and for good reason. Many thought it was Oliver Evans, a photographer from Devil's Lake who had planned on moving. Oliver Evans was popular in Devil's Lake and well-known around much of the state. In 1905, 6 years before the Topeka fire, the Fargo Forum called him the leading photographer of Devil's Lake. The comment appeared in a story about Evans and a partner purchasing Freeman's Photography Gallery in Fargo. The partner would focus on the Fargo establishment, while Evans would devote time to the Devil's Lake Gallery. The name of the business was changed to Drysdale and Evans. In 1906, Evans took a Devil's Lake newspaper editor on an automobile tour, showcasing his automobile skills. Though the day was beautiful, there were no photographs taken to commemorate the event. In the afternoon paper, the editor reported, "Friend Evans did not take his camera, for," said he, "with my wife and an editor along, I shall have enough to perplex me without doing any field work." Later that year, multiple newspapers reported an interesting tidbit that Evans owned a book that was over 200 years old. Published in 1641, it was titled Moses, His Choice, by Jeremiah Burroughs. As it turned out, Oliver Evans was a victim of misidentification, for he had not yet left Devil's Lake, nor did he have family living in Topeka. In fact, on this date, he was still arranging to sell his gallery. After receiving many calls about the Topeka fire from papers around the state, the Devil's Lake Weekly World checked on Evans, who asked that his friends be notified that he was a lively corpse. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
All arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's it for this Thursday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great Labor Day weekend. Main Street returns on Tuesday next week after Labor Day. And that's when we hope to see you again, right here on Main Street.